helpful and make great interventions into urbanism without necessarily creating an envelope of a building, right? There's a lot, I mean, architecture, if we reduce architectural practice to making buildings, then we've really lost, the argument already. When in fact, architecture is a much broader, has a much greater sort of kit of tools, I think, that are useful for urbanism that have hardly been explored. I think modernists, I wish I had your optimism about modern architecture, but I don't, having spent too much time with it, I guess.
Yeah, that's
tremendous.
I was just quite surprised because the last slide was actually my work.
Oh, yay! I love it! Well done!
It's a surprise to be in amongst all of that. Yeah.
You deserve it.
Do reference me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have liked to have referenced everybody that I showed here. I'm sorry that I couldn't.
No, it's right. It does get a bit kind of caught up in the whole exhibition.
Yeah, but it's a great piece of work. Congratulations.
It's nice to see you.
Just to go back to a little bit of the earlier conversation, it struck me that throughout it, in a way, maybe you're just, you would take some things as read.
Mm-hmm.
But throughout, you discussed very little the notion of ownership.
Ownership. Yeah. Right.
Because the relationship of who owns what,
mm-hmm.
and who makes the money out of doing what,
right.
and what constitutes the occupier as opposed to the owner,
right.
seems to me really central to,
right.
to a lot of the tropes and the particular myths of urbanism you're looking at. So
yeah.
that the sense of whether something is owned by the local authority or the public or by landlords of a certain type, etc. I think all those elements maybe add a layer of complexity.
Absolutely.
That, you know, I'm not quite sure where that was yet,
right.
or whether your choice of examples were part of a very particular aspect.
It's a great point, Oriana, and I think in expanding this into a written piece, one would want to look very closely at not only notions of ownership, but just the whole concept of property itself, which, you know, in the United States, a very, very deeply ingrained set of tropes, basically. And what's interesting in the case of these American cities is that, you know, of course, no one who lives in those areas that were being depicted owns anything in them, right? And so, and this is something I write about and I'm working on now. And in fact, the kind of modern project of city planning is really not itself geared towards an attack on the people who live in those places, but is an attack on the slumlords as the central problem. Where there are certainly urban reformers and other people, eugenicists even, who will argue that the people who live in those places are the cause of the problems in places. Most planners and most social reformers worth their salt understood that that wasn't the case. They knew that the real problems lie with the slumlords.
But some of the slumlords were public bodies.
Not in this case, yeah.
But in Europe,
yeah, right.
A lot more so.
Yeah, and that's something I would have to look at very carefully, too. In this case, these are really, this is the Wild West of real estate. And so, you know, the market is really, it's the market. And this is private real estate, it's most rapacious. And it's most capitalist. And even, especially in the early 19th, late 20th century, there's not even such a thing as a public ownership body. I mean, there's no concept that government owns things like land, right? That is a 20th century invention that comes later, in fact.
Because I think some of those images, those recurring tropes you're talking about, is that sense of a denial of the idea of the home. So
yeah.
The existence,
mm-hmm.
and family life and community goes on outside of an interior space.
Right.
Because you're not, you know, the interior spaces when you see them are often images of sweatshops. And I mean, there's
yeah.
that whole other way in which there isn't setting up that
right.
idea, which maybe you get when you get similar type approaches to rural existence,
no,
and things like Walker Evans and
yeah.
The Works Project Administration photographs.
You're absolutely right, and in fact, that's a whole area of this I couldn't even get into. It's certainly part of the book I'm writing now because it's very important to public housing and the history of social housing. The family, of course, is under deep attack in these images, and that's a whole area of rhetoric that really I couldn't get into. But you know, you, the the basically they're kind of fighting the Reformation, you know, in these images. I mean, this is the kind of Protestant middle class basically suggesting that the kind of way of forming families in these slum areas among Catholics and Jews and others is malformed, that these are malformed conditions of family life and that they have to be eradicated. And that's a very powerful discourse that emerges in the 19th and early 20th century in the United States. And it can you can trace that very closely in the architecture, because once they build public housing, almost all projects only give people two or three bedrooms. What are you going to do with two or three bedrooms? You have 16 children. I mean, it's preposterous, right? So they're actually architecturally configuring and prefiguring a certain structure of family life, right? That actually forestalls, in some ways, spells the doom of public housing from very early on.
Even the E block used to be a married quarters where mm-hmm. underneath you have a rather nicer. I remember when I went in there before it was renovated, and it's just for the soldiers' families, and it's tiny, poor thing. I mean, even if you have one kid, it's just too cramped, and very often they did have more than one. So, and whereas in the A block, you have the officers' block, these sort of paneled rooms. See,
yeah.
So I mean that's
right.
Very clear, and it's just not that common.
And they would give you two bedrooms, and then say, "Oh, and by the way, children of the same of different sex can't inhabit a bedroom together." So I mean, what are you going to do, right? I mean, there's clearly people who are just simply just excluded outright from moving into improved housing.
This kind of made me remind myself of projects in Hong Kong where I've been living. Years and thinking about public, private, and who owns the space, and also the idea that you sort of thematize
mm-hmm.
the whole city, and Wong Kar Wai through Wat Avis, the City of Culture and Disappearance,
right.
Is that Hong Kong is no longer a place of the 60s, everything is thematized, everything has been pulled down, everything to do with pre-colonial, post-colonial is all fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, where do people go? I mean, they live on the edges of in Shenzhen, these multiple high rises that
right.
look like something from a metropolis,
right.
or you get your social housing. I mean, I'm just curious where do people actually live in the end?
Well, Shenzhen is actually a very interesting case. I could go on and on about Shenzhen, but you know, in this case, when you look at that those vast tower blocks of Bruidago that I showed there, it's important to keep in mind that in the United States, only 2% of the housing that was built. Only 2% of the housing stock was ever publicly owned. Very tiny, very, very tiny, compared to the Netherlands, where 60% at one point was social housing. So the United States built hundreds of thousands of housing units publicly, but that's a drop in the bucket compared to the population. And so most people continued to live in those old slum neighborhoods and just felt worse and worse about themselves for doing so because the kind of tropes were so powerful about what it meant to live in slum neighborhoods, and they were denigrated for so long. And then, lo and behold, once you find out that you live in an interesting neighborhood in the 1970s and 80s, then your rent goes up and you get displaced and other people move in and gentrification occurs. So it's a kind of you can never win situation. It's really kind of a sad story. But that's the story of real estate in the United States. Now it's going to be a different story elsewhere, although gentrification obviously is a powerful force here as well.
More questions?
This is speculation. I mean, this is really a glance at a very early set of ideas that I'm hoping to work on in the next 4 or 5 years. So any help you can give me at this early phase would be very appreciated.
It must be hard to look at the laundry lines.
Yeah.
Because there's a way in which when you see the pictures of the ideal homes in the suburbs, it's okay to have
mm-hmm.
laundry. That's
right.
A nice thing. The wind blows nicely.
Because it's in your private backyard.
In
your
garden,
right.
Your garden. But somewhere other laundry anywhere else, it's, oh my goodness, it's a slum if there's laundry
yeah.
visible on the balconies or
yep.
between the towns.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
Because in Munich, you're not allowed to hang any washing out.
Yeah.
Finding out about this business of the drape and washing,
yeah.
it's quite interesting because it does make you wonder whether that was a first attempt to prove that there are no slums.
Right. Well, New York too. New York also passed laws. You can't do that in New York anymore. the city of laundry. You know, you can't hang laundry up.
Like in Switzerland, I remember you can't hang it out on Sundays.
Yeah. Other questions, complaints, consternations?
So a lot of the images, this seems to be obviously this outsider view of slums and things like that. I'm wondering if in looking through the archives and things, you ever, I guess especially in the second half of the century, fall upon images of an insider view, maybe photography or drawings, things like that, especially with art projects. And if so, are the tropes different? Is there a different language or other being communicated?
No, it's an excellent question, and that's something I constantly keep my eye out for, because even a tiny sort of fragment of that would be wonderful. But you know, even if I found something, it would be the exception that you know proves the rule, right? I mean, but the fact is that I've never found anything like that ever. Now, obviously, once you get to the 60s, 70s, there's more consciousness around these questions. I think you begin to get more insider perspectives. You begin to get people. I mean, there's art projects within these urban communities that are driven at the community level, and you know, the Model Cities program that was created by the federal government had an arts component, and there's some actually remarkable art projects that were done by kids who lived in Pruitt-Igoe public housing project. I have photographs of those, and they'll be in the book. But that's the 60s and 70s. I mean, really in the 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, I mean, maybe there was, of course, but it hasn't survived that I've been able to see. Would love it if it did.
Just one thing I'm interested in, what you make of Brasilia, because that was obviously a modern city created to avoid any slum emergence or anything. And
right.
It was designed as the perfect city, and yet there are little umbrellas of slums dotted all over. And I wondered what
they cropped up immediately. Yeah. In fact, the workers who built Brasilia created those and then just stayed. Right? Yeah. New towns are a phenomenon that fascinates me, these kind of post-World War II new towns. They crop up all over the world, in fact, right here in the UK, for example. So these are kind of, you know, America went one way, right? America went the way of vast expansion just out in every single direction from the urban core, right? So development on green fields, taking over farms, churning them up and creating suburbs. With basically no plan, right? That's our version of urban expansion. The New Town movement, that was actually a global movement in a lot of ways, at least the transnational movement, was really about a kind of alternative to that, planned a set of interventions that we planned for expanding housing options for people that nevertheless you know, kept them concentrated, kept them you know, governable, kept them predictable, those sorts of things. Brasilia is a classic case in point, but I mean, there are many. Emil Hempstead is one of these, you know, many others in the UK. It's actually a fascinating movement. There's only one of these ever built in the United States, Reston, Virginia, in the 60s, and then it was just never took off.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening.
Bless this.
What? Oh! See, so.